I'm Afua Hirsch.
I'm Peter Frankopan.
And in our podcast, Legacy, we explore the lives of some of the biggest characters in history.
This season, we're exploring the life of Cleopatra.
An iconic life full of romances, sieges, and tragedy. But who was the real Cleopatra? It feels like her story's been told by others with their own agenda for centuries.
But her legacy is enduring, and so we're going to dive into how her story has evolved all the way up to today.
I am so excited to talk about Cleopatra, Peter.
Love Cleopatra.
She is an icon.
She's the most famous woman in antiquity. It's got to be up there with the most famous woman of all time.
But I think there's a huge gap between how familiar people are with the idea of her compared to what they actually know about her life and character.
So for pyramids, Cleopatra and Cleopatra's nose.
Follow Legacy now wherever you get your podcasts. Or you can binge entire seasons early and ad-free on Wondery Plus.
Rarer than art, and as valuable as precious metals, the economy of the early modern world was shaped by the pursuit of its single most important commodity, spice. Transported to Europe through a network of complex trade routes, the exact source for many spices remained unknown. But all this changed in 1511 with the Portuguese discovery of the Moluccas, the so-called Spice Islands. The next six decades brought intense change, from the linking of trade routes across oceans to the increasing manufacture of merchant ships and armaments and the origins of the first truly global economy, all in the hope of controlling the world's most valuable asset. Joining me today to talk about the European battle for spice and its enduring effects on the world is the New York Times best-selling author Roger Crowley. His latest work of compelling narrative history is Spice, the 16th century contest that shaped the modern world. Roger Crowley, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to Not Just the Tudors.
Thank you very much, Susanna. It's a great pleasure to be here.
This is an exciting topic. Can you take us at the very beginning back to the early 16th century and give us some basics? Where in the world were the Spice Islands? What were they? What was grown there and why they were important?
The Spice Islands are in the Malay Archipelago, which is a kind of 4,000-mile arc. It's about a quarter of the world's diameter. A little group of islands, which are now effectively in the Philippines. And the critical issue here is that they sit on the fault line between two species systems. One is that of Asia, the other is that of Oceania, Australasia. And on this fault line, it's like a laboratory of evolution. It was here that Alfred Wallace, the 19th century naturalist, really fleshed out the theory of evolution at the same time as Darwin. And in the middle of this, there are a tiny group of islands, we call them Moluccas. And the most extraordinary thing about this is that there are five small islands, the only places in the world where cloves grew. A few hundred miles south, there's a second group of islands called the Bandas, which are the only place in the world where nutmeg grew. And if you go deep into history, you can find spice cloves on the banks of the Euphrates. Possibly because of their rarity value, they've always had an incredibly vivid presence in the human imagination. I think people thought that they were analgesics, they were aphrodisiacs, they were a kind of a portal to the divine. And throughout history, it seems odd to us now when we look at our spice cabinets, but they have been almost the first global commodity. They were very handy from that point of view. They're lightweight. You can stuff a lot of this stuff into a ship. And it's reasonably durable. And Europe was getting spices in the Middle Ages, usually through the hands of many Islamic middlemen. Massively expensive. They were like a prestige item. If you were incredibly wealthy, you'd have cloves or nutmeg in your meat, whatever. So they had this magical presence in the imagination of Europe. At the same time, we have to think that part of that imagination was focused by certainly the influence of Marco Polo and the way that he had projected the whole of the Orient as being critical. Columbus, in the marginal note in his edition of Marco Polo's work in Latin, said that he was going for spices, gold, and gems. So they focus something exotic beyond the European world.
You mentioned there that the control of the trade was chiefly in the hands of Muslim kingdoms. Is that still the case at the very beginning of the 16th century? And if so, by what means was the trade secured?
It was a whole network of trading points in the hands of very many middlemen, from Spice Islands to somewhere like Malacca or to Goa on the west coast of India, across the Indian Ocean to the Red Sea, taken by other merchants up the Red Sea, carried by camels to Cairo, up the Nile to Alexandria, where you'd meet some Venetians and Genoese who are going to buy this stuff. It moved through the hands of very many people, which is why the markup by the time you got to Europe was about 1,000%. And this diurnal trade, which depended very much upon the monsoon, was very ancient and very well established.
And given that the rewards were this value, you know, the markup of 1,000% you mentioned, that suggests that it must have been worth taking those risks. So that's a lot of travelling. That's a lot of effort. People must have been getting rich from this in order to carry on doing it.
Yes, absolutely. Cities were founded and prospered throughout Asia on this trade, and it was definitely worth the risk. It certainly was. There was a time when spices were more valuable than gold. It was the first global commodity, really, the first globally traded thing. And certainly Mamluk Egypt totally depended upon that trade, was supported by Genoese and Venetians pitching up at Alexandria. And it was really kept the Mamluk dynasty going until it was wiped out by the Ottomans in 1517. So yes, it was definitely worth the risk.
Now, you mentioned Columbus. This is a time of enormous exploration and expansion. So what impact did that have? How was that sort of interrupting the control of the spice trade in the early 16th century?
It took a while for this really to take off. And it was really when the Portuguese, when Vasco da Gama went to India in the 1490s and brought spices back round the Cape of Good Hope to Lisbon, that it froze the blood of Venetians and caused bank crashes because they suddenly thought that their whole business model was out of date. If you could stuff a hold full of spices into a ship, that was going to be far more lucrative than the dribs and drabs that you got at an enormous expense at the hands of Islamic middlemen who you didn't really want to trade with anyway. So you can see it in the annals of Venice, a moment at which Venice really freaked out over the Vasco da Gama story. In fact, they thought it was actually Columbus who'd done it. But yeah, it shook people.
So there's a European race to discover the Spice Islands. What were the main challenges facing those in Europe in their search to try and conquer the islands?
By the time the Portuguese had got to Malacca and taken Malacca in 1511, they had a pretty good sailing network back into Europe. Beyond that, they didn't really know where they were or how to get to them, although they had captured some charts, and they depended upon local Malay pilots who were merchant traders to take them into the Spice Islands. And the challenge really when they arrived was trying to work out how this really complicated little group of islands operated, the power structures, the rivalries, what were they going to trade with what, and the enormous complexity of inter-island politics within the Moluccas was quite challenging. But the Portuguese were enormously good at gathering information. They'd had many years of garnering information about the places they were going to, asking questions, finding translators, and they worked out fairly quickly how much you pay, who's on what side, and they chose one island, Ternate, over another island, Tidore, and how to manage things. But it was never easy because of the enormous intertribal politics of these islands. And they also had to work out the sailing seasons, the diurnal swing of the monsoon, and they had to work out sailing routes. But they were very good information gatherers, the Portuguese, so they learned this quickly.
And they weren't the only ones trying to do this. What can we learn about the battle, I suppose, between Portugal and Spain over trade rights?
The Portuguese arrived there first. The Spanish, to do with the deep politics of the Atlantic, had to sail west. And it was only when Magellan made it round into the Pacific that they confronted each other. But we see a kind of extraordinary micro-war being fought in the Moluccas between these two adversaries who are separated by about 500 yards of sea. A very vicious little contest to get control of this terrain, and extraordinary narratives of the tit-for-tats of they co-opted their local allies, they raided, they plundered. They really spent 20 years slugging it out on the other side of the world. Very weird little contest with very small groups of men. But they felt that what was at stake really was the control of the whole pot.
One could imagine that this European war played out in these islands was massively disruptive to the indigenous people. What sort of evidence do we have about their experience and how they responded to these settlers?
Unfortunately, we have very little written knowledge of how the people of the Spice Islands responded. Almost everything that we know is filtered through Spanish and Portuguese narratives. And there was certainly a point where they just wanted to get rid of these people altogether. And there was a point, actually, when the Spanish and the Portuguese had to cooperate. They built forts to protect themselves. And there was a point when, really, they were forced back on temporary alliances to deal with the threat. Basically, as far as we can understand it, the Portuguese and the Spanish were totally unwelcome in the scheme of things. They were disruptive, they were brutal, they wanted monopoly trading, whereas actually the Spice Islands drew on all sorts of people from across the Malay archipelago coming and buying stuff, and people would come from the Philippines, from China and so on. So they would have loved to have expelled these intruders, but it just wasn't possible. They couldn't do it.
It's really interesting that you can say that the Portuguese and Spanish were brutal, but that we don't have that from indigenous sources. So that raises an interesting question, because it means that we're finding the material in their own accounts. Is there a sense that they feel entitled to act in that way?
The answer is yes, really. Of course, there's also a missionary dimension to this. St. Francis Xavier turns up and found it very unrewarding trying to turn these people into Christians. They felt that they were entitled to act in that way. The Portuguese had laid claims to Malacca, they'd laid claims to Goa, they'd laid claims to Ormuz at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, and they laid a claim to the Moluccas. They stuck their flag on the map called the Miller Atlas from about 1519, and you've got the Moluccas with an enormous Portuguese flag on them. They felt that they were driven by God. They had a prerogative and a right to do this.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
American politics are all struggle and strategy, passion and persuasion, and so much scandal. And they always have been. I'm Don Wildman, and on American History Hit, we're delving into Alexander Hamilton, whose bio was big enough for Broadway. From war to women and a dueling death to boot, Hamilton is a fundamental chapter of the American tale. Join me and a cast of worldly experts to meet the real Alexander Hamilton on American History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's dig a little bit deeper then into the way in which the Spanish were attempting to find a route to the islands and were going the opposite way round, and what that meant for relations between the two countries, because it's an interesting time. You know, we've got diplomatic marriages happening between Spain and Portugal on one half of the globe, and on the other half, this battle being played out. And we obviously have talked about the value of spice and exactly the riches it could bring. But I suppose not many people look at their spice racks today and think this had enormous consequences on the lives of people, that this could lead to this degree of war. So for those who don't know anything about it, could you outline some of the events of those tumultuous years?
I agree. It's very difficult for us now to understand how important spices were when we look at our spice racks. But the first up, really, was that the Spanish had to learn to sail around South America. And the real issue was that nobody had any measure of the size of the Pacific Ocean. It's 9,500 miles from the Straits of Magellan to the Moluccas. It's a volume of water which is larger than all the terrestrial land masses in the world. And crossing this sea was incredibly difficult, because really, for a very long period of 3 months, you sailed with no opportunity to reprovision yourself. And these crews are going to be decimated by scurvy. Scurvy will start killing a crew if they don't get vitamin C within about 110 days. And the brutality of this, and it took them a long time to realize how big the Pacific was, the sheer tales of suffering are extraordinary, really, in just getting there. The problem then for the Spanish was, having got there, how do they get back again? How do they take the stuff back again? They couldn't sail west because that was Portuguese territory and they'd had a treaty around that. And anyway, the Portuguese had a much better hold on that area and would capture them. So we see a series of voyages, one after another, where they get to the Moluccas, they get some stuff, and then they try to sail back across the Pacific. And it's a lobster pot. They can't get out. And there are about four voyages, successive voyages, where they set sail and they're just blown back by the winds and end up having to surrender to the Portuguese and then get repatriated by being put on Portuguese ships, those who survived, and making it back to Europe. So the suffering, the sheer loss of human life is quite extraordinary, really. And this is only going to be solved when one of the great forgotten heroes, if you can call them that, of the age of navigation. We think about Columbus, Vasco da Gama, Magellan, and the fourth name in that is a man called Andres de Urdaneta. Urdaneta spent something like 12 years on the Moluccas. He went at 17, he came back at the age of 28. But he was a very bright guy, and he spent a lot of time studying the pattern of the winds. And eventually, in 1565, Philip, King of Spain after Charles, launches an expedition from Mexico, and with the sole purpose of getting to the island and making it back again. This is like a moonshot. The problem for NASA was, you can send the people up there, can you get them back again? But Urdaneta had studied the meteorology of the Pacific Ocean in a great deal of detail, and it was the best equipped expedition they'd ever had. And he worked out that you had to sail northeast, pick up a wind, and you could make it back to Acapulco. And it worked. And this was a crowning moment in global oceanic connectivity. It was the final link in the chain that allowed Europeans to sail all the way around the world. And every year from then on, when the Spanish established a foothold in the Philippines at Manila, every year the Manila galleon would make that voyage back to Mexico. And this was the link in the chain that linked all the oceans together and was a critical point in a global trading network. And Urdaneta, who was by that time actually a priest, was the man who did it. He's slightly forgotten. He was a Basque from northern Spain, and it was a remarkable achievement.
It's so true. I mean, it's not a name that most people would be able to give you if you asked them. And yet, as you say, it's so fundamental. Thank you for bringing him to our attention. Now, we're in the 1560s by this point, but if we were to zip forward in the following decades, we see that then the Spanish and the Portuguese are not the only ones who want to get in on the act. How is the spice trade connected to the establishment of the East India Companies?
That's a fascinating story, I think. There were in Seville a trading merchant from Bristol, Robert Thorne and Roger Barlow. These were Bristolian merchants, licensed to trade, and they had been there when Elcano came back from the first expedition, the 245 people who set out with Magellan, 18 made it back. And they saw the wealth that was being made. These guys are also slavers, we have to say. But they realised that there was no possibility that England could muscle in on this trade. But they thought maybe there is another way, and that other way could be by sailing round Russia. And they wrote to Henry VIII to say, we're missing out on this. And England's trade, 85% of its trade was in cloth, a dangerous kind of proportion, if you like. But the central figure in this for them was Sebastian Cabot. The Cabots had been in Bristol. His father, John Cabot, had sailed for England and claimed North America for England. His son, Sebastian, who was actually a key figure in the Spanish navigational hierarchy, he was what was called the pilot major. He was the chief navigator who controlled all kinds of activities, the map making and so on. And we think that Sebastian Cabot probably slipped Robert Thorne a map of the world that was quite handy, which he sent back to England. And Cabot, he was a creature of opportunity, like so many of these people. He was Genoese, but he'd sailed for Spain, and then he defected to England. He comes to England, and he puts his proposal to, effectively by this stage, Henry VIII is dead, and we've got Edward VI, who's a very young man, that there is another way we could sail round Russia out of the reach of Spain and Portugal and make it to Cathay, China, and the Spice Islands. It's difficult now to understand how people made these speculative leaps. The thing about Thorne's map was that it handily cut off just before you got to the top of Russia, so there was no way of seeing whether there was a way around or not. And it's hard to get into the mentality of the people who think, we're going to give that a go. But they did. And one of the instruments that Cabot introduced was a joint stock company that merchants all contributed a certain amount of money. This is not an imperial expedition. This is a merchant's expedition. And these kinds of structures were in place in Venice and Genoa. And he introduced this to England. So the merchants contributed in this. And a voyage was made, which came to a certain sort of slightly grisly end off the coast of Russia, where two ships of the leader, Sir Hugh Willoughby, were frozen in and they all died. But the third ship, the Chancellor, the inestimable Chancellor, John Dee called him, actually managed to sail into the White Sea, where Archangel is, take a sledge to Moscow and strike up a trade deal with Ivan the Terrible. But this financial model, this is consolidated into a company called the Muscovy Company, which traded with Russia reasonably well in its own terms, and they sold cloth to Russians and so on. But that model, John Dee, who thought about this and thought, he's the first person to use the word, I think, British Empire. But that model of the joint stock company is consolidated, I think, in about 1601 into the East India Company. So we're beginning to see the origins from this voyage and Cabot's presence of a mercantile, independent, not crown-based, entrepreneurial, financial, flexible structure. And this is really, I think, going to be very critical in the development of England's presence in the world.
Absolutely. And it's worth remembering, though, that the East Indies that the company is interested in the first place is not India. It is very much the era we've been talking about.
Absolutely, yes, it was. The English are enormously interested in getting the spices as well. And we have to remember, of course, that Drake had sailed round the Magellan Straits and made it to the Moluccas and was very well received. They had a kind of backcloth to this, and also managed to plunder a Manila galleon along the way, which was quite handy. So, you know, he was a sort of prototype of this thing. And yes, that was where they went. But they would be nudged out by the Dutch in the next iteration of Europeans wanting to get the stuff.
Well, then, we've looked over the course of the 16th century and beyond at this European pursuit of the Spice Islands. As we come towards the end of our time together, could you give me a sense of the long-term effects of this pursuit? Because in some ways, they're still with us.
I think the long-term effect of this was that the Spice Islands were the goal for which they aimed, but this network of trading routes which they established allowed a flow of commodities around the world. But at the same time, it was also the jumping-off point from which the Portuguese and the Spanish pushed further into the east, the Portuguese into China and then Japan, with slightly unfortunate consequences for themselves in some respects, and then the establishment of global trading hubs like Manila, which is going to allow goods to flow around the world. So it really moves. What comes out of this is, one, a global network of cities, Manila, Macau, Mexico City, Seville, Malacca, Lisbon, Goa, which are all bound together in trading terms, and that provides all kinds of things. And out of this comes the most extraordinary consequences, I think, because this return voyage across the Pacific allows the Spanish to take it one step further when they start exporting silver from the mountains of Peru. Potosí was a mountain in Peru which produced half the world's silver in the 16th and 17th century. The most extraordinary mining boom ever, where almost the size of London, a mountain of 16,000 feet up in the Andes. And in 1571 is like a critical moment, I think. Manila is established as a hub. At about the same time, the Chinese decided to overhaul their tax system and that everything should be paid for in silver. So what happens is that the Spanish import vast quantities of silver to sell into China, with places like Manila and Macau all be involved in sort of triangular trades. And back comes exporting out of China and to a lesser extent Japan, consumer durables like particularly Ming pottery, silk, all kinds of things. And it's like a model of today. Everywhere China produced and Europe consumed, we have got a whole global trading system at work here. Flow of bullion, flow of commodities. By the middle of the 16th century, a Portuguese nobleman could commission a dinner set from Ming China with his coat of arms on it. And you see in Vermeer's famous picture of a woman with a balance, she's weighing silver exactly at the same time as a Portuguese missionary in China had seen Chinese people doing exactly the same thing. So we're starting to see this acceleration of goods flowing around the world, changing all kinds of things. We are at that point seeing a global economic structure coming into place.
Well, of all people, you are very well placed to have written about this. Anyone who has read your previous works like Conquerors, City of Fortune, 1453, will know that you deeply understand things like empire and trade and expansion and colonialism, and at the same time write utterly beautifully. And your new book is no exception. So those who have had their appetites whetted, if we can say that, by the Spice today should pick up a copy of your new book, Spice, the 16th century contest that shaped the modern world. Thank you so much for taking the time to give us a flavour of it.
Thanks very much, Susan. It was really enjoyable.
And thanks to you for listening to Not Just the Tudors from History Hit. And also to my researcher, Alice Smith, and my producer, Rob Weinberg. We are always eager to hear from you, so do drop us a line at notjustthetudors@historyhit.com or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Not Just Tudors. And please remember to follow Not Just the Tudors wherever you get your podcasts, so you get each new episode as soon as it's released. History is full of extraordinary people, the Tudors being just a handful. In my latest film on History Hit, we meet Bess of Hardwick and go inside the incredible house that she built, a house that defines the elegance and grandeur of the Elizabethan age. A house fit for a woman who climbed to the top of the Tudor social ladder. To find out more about the life of Bess and many more fascinating figures from the past, sign up via the link in the description with the code TUDORS for an exclusive discount.